Progressive.com/future.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte grapples with its highest murder count since the early 90s. The city's first African-American female mayor takes office, along with a majority of young newcomers to city council. Faced with charges of misconduct in the workplace, Panthers owner Jerry Richardson puts up a for sale sign. A new school superintendent takes the helm at CMS. HB2 falls by the wayside, and Charlotte learns some uncomfortable things about itself in the wake of a police shooting. No, you're not in a time warp. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more on this year-in-review edition of the Local News Roundup. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE Newsroom. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist at Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV. Happy holidays.
Hey, has it been a year already?
Already, yes. Ann Doss Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I'm running out of holiday greetings. Nice to have you with us.
Thank
you. And Glenn Birkins is editor and founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
All of that.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
Bon voyage. You can. We're just going to do the show here at kind of an end-of-year review and look back on some of the stories that we've been talking about for a long, long time in some cases. This will not be like the end-of-year countdown that Casey Kasem used to do. We're not going to do this in order of the favorite hits or anything like that. But let's start the year with the bad and something we've been talking about, and that is the rising homicide count. Glenn, you say this was the biggest story of 2017 in your mind. Why?
It was. It was certainly the biggest story of 2017 with our readers. There's no real explanation for what causes the homicide rate to rise and fall in any year. We had seen several years where the homicide rate was low, and even during tough economic times, it remained low. Then all of a sudden, for no reason, or at least no apparent reason at all, 2017, the lid blew off, and we saw this rapid increase. We got off to a horrendous start to this year. Fortunately, that homicide rate did slow just a little.
And most of these homicides are by people who know the people being killed and vice versa.
Absolutely. Very few of them were by people who did not know their his or her attacker. We even had a couple, I believe, that were domestic violence related, where we had multiple people who died. But going back, police officers and people who study these things, they're loath to explain why the homicide rate rises one year and falls another.
I mean, could it be connected somehow to the zeitgeist? I mean, there seems to be a great deal of anger and frustration in the nation at large, left and right, Democrat, Republican, etc. Could that be playing a role in this? Just anger?
I don't know. People are angry. I think people are angry. Unfortunately, or however you want to look at it, we're seeing most of these homicides continue to be young African-American males.
Right.
That's just a fact.
Well, let's add despair to that.
Well, despair, perhaps. And unfortunately, most of these victims happen to be young African-American males.
Right.
Yeah, and I just want to play off of something that Glenn was talking about. I mean, one of the more confusing things here is there is no simple, clear pattern. You can see a large number of these unfortunate homicides had ties to domestic abuse, domestic violence. But then, you know, earlier this year, there's this really fascinating statistic that was actually published in the Observer, which is that five victims of homicide this year were believed to have been killed by a son or a son-in-law with no understanding as to why. Mm. That's the head scratcher, and I think why Glenn is right. This is a huge story because if it was back in the 90s when the cause was crack cocaine,
right,
or if it was in the early 2000s when the cause was clearly just, you know, often attributed to gang violence, it's still bad. Every death is a tragedy, but it's understandable. What is worrisome about this is there is no clear, you know, virus that's leading to this contagion. It's just it seems to be popping up and all over.
And it's not just Charlotte. It's cities all over the country.
Mary.
That's also difficult, as you say, when you're talking about a virus, when you're looking for the cure, because you're striking out and saying, what are ways, because obviously the police and the citizens want to know, how can we fix this? You see, they have created the Family Justice Center. They're trying to go to have all the social services for domestic violence under one roof. That's one solution. So that is the big question. What do we do next?
And I would say that as traumatic as these homicides are, they're part of really an even bigger story in which Charlotte and the country sort of grapples with crime and punishment. Mm-hmm. That yes, you have this horrible violence, most of it fueled by guns. We were at least lucky not to have a mass shooting this year, in a year when so many of these happened all over. We hope that this is the case for the whole year. But we've dealt with – there's been intense scrutiny of the police and how they're handling their encounters with armed citizens. We're having questions about the criminal justice system. The Observer has spent a good bit of 2017 looking at the prison system and ways in which the guards in the system, the employees of the system, have been at times perpetrators of brutality, but also on the receiving end of really dangerous behavior. So I think a lot of questions about where we ought to be going with this, not a lot of answers
But
yet.
Bringing it back to Charlotte, correct me if I'm wrong, Glenn, you cite the murder of that popular barber at the No Grease Barbershop this year, and the double homicide in another part of town, just minutes apart from each other. You cite those as the ones that brought all this into focus.
I think there were two, actually. I think there was one other. There was a college professor at UNC Charlotte, mm-hmm. who was killed allegedly, or by her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's easy to distance ourselves from homicides. It's always someone else. It's mm-hmm. or we try to explain it away that, well, there's a reason that person was killed. In those two instances, in the case with the barber and as well as with the UNC Charlotte professor, those were people who, for lack of a better phrase, should not have been victims of homicide. They weren't, to our knowledge, they weren't involved in anything illegal. And so I think anytime when people like that are victims of homicide, it just brings it a lot closer to who most of us are.
All public officials have been talking about this year. They're all saying we have to do something. CMPD Chief Kirk Putney said in October that groups across the city will have to cooperate to make a difference. But he added, sometimes I feel like the lone voice in the wilderness screaming, we have to do something. Really? Is he alone in this?
No, he's not. But I do think what you're getting at is another one of the biggest stories when it comes to the homicide rate this year. The year that, Kirk Putney, chief of CMPD, says, I'm not pulling any punches anymore. We need to start really doing – like, he has been vocal, and his criticism has been pointed and, frankly, just, hard-hitting. I mean, you earlier this year held a public conversation, a Charlotte Talks episode, about the homicide rate. And right. Kirk Putney, I think all of us who were there knew that he was – beyond having to worry about playing politics.
Actually, I've never seen a public official be that honest.
And his honesty was directed at every layer of society. I mean, from rich to poor, white to African American.
And he was angry.
And he was at inactions on all sides. I mean, there was one moment where he said, when we're talking about this, and we should be talking about it because I'm not sure what the percentage is, but a significant portion of the homicides are African American men.
Right.
And he said, Kirk Putney was addressing, wealthy whites. And he said, if you don't want to get down there in these areas that makes you uncomfortable, and I'm paraphrasing here, but if you don't want to be there, that's fine. Give us the cash. Give the people who can make a difference the money, because you have to be involved in this fight. And if you're not going to be their boots on the ground, then open up your paychecks and help the people who are trying to get
it
done.
But he also talked about a lot of, and the assistant chief was on another public conversation with that we had, and she also talked about a lot of the initiatives that CMPD have been doing to try to build relationships mm-hmm. with the community and to bring young men into the police department to say, we don't have to be adversaries here. How can we work together? How can we short-circuit all this? Are those efforts paying off?
I guess if you look at the homicide rate, you would have to say that they're not necessarily paying off. It's hard to know what the rate might be were it not for those. But I want to go back to something you said just a second ago in terms of him feeling like the lone voice in the wilderness. He's not the lone voice in the wilderness. But I do agree with one thing, and I'll probably take some heat here. I don't think there is the sense of emergency that I would like to see in the African-American community to address this homicide rate. I don't want to mix apples and oranges, but we in the African-American community tend to get very upset when there is a police shooting, and we should, because those are agents of the state, and we should absolutely hold them accountable when they take human life. Mm-hmm. But we should also be concerned when young black man kills young black man. And I don't see that feeling of emergency like I would like to see it. And once again, that's not a Charlotte phenomenon. That's a national phenomenon.
So do you?
I think, you know, you do have some organizations that have been here for a long time, Mothers of Murdered Offspring.
Absolutely.
And others who have been on the ground. And sometimes these organizations don't get as much publicity when people say, why aren't black folks out in the street when? But a lot of them have been.
Yeah.
And they need to, and that's been in every city too. And they need to take credit for being there no matter what. And you do have some new voices coming in. But also we need to give them some credit.
Absolutely. And I said early on that Chief Putney is not the only – it's not the lone voice. Mm-hmm. There are voices out there. But those voices need to be louder.
So are we to assume that this increased murder count will continue into the new year, that we'll see that this was worse than last year, and we knew that very early in this last year. We knew this was going to be a worse year than 2016. Are we likely to see 2018 being worse than 2017?
I don't think we can necessarily.
I agree. I mean, here's the thing. Look at 2016, and then all of a sudden 2017 rolls around, and we're all scratching our heads saying, what on earth is going on here? Right. Just as it shoots up, who knows? Glenn, I think you're exactly right.
Okay. Mayor Jennifer Roberts lost her job this year. She lost it in the primary to Mayor Pro Tem and fellow Democrat Vi Lyles, who was sworn in as the city's first female African-American mayor last month. Republican Kenny Smith, of course, we talked about this a lot, thought he'd be running against Roberts. Is that what most people expected?
Absolutely. I'll say that outright. Absolutely. I think everybody knew that Vi Lyles would run a close second is what everybody I spoke to thought that it would be. Charlotte voters had not voted out a sitting mayor in a primary in a long time. So the safe bet was that Jennifer Roberts would squeak by Vi Lyles and that she and Kenny Smith would go head to head in the general.
Well, I think Kenny Smith's problem was in the general, he ran against Jennifer Roberts instead of Vi Lyles.
Well, and his problem was also that he's a Republican.
He's a Republican in Charlotte. But, I mean, that was one of the things that caught him up because Vi Lyles, people knew her.
So the question is, why did she lose her job? Was it because she did a bad job? Was it because she was a victim of circumstances, the unrest that followed the Heath Scott shooting? Was it because of her people? Some said she vacillated on her support for the police in that instance, that she spoke only to the national media. Was it because of the ordinance that she kind of prodded the council to pass that led to HB2? Was it because of HB2? Was it all these things?
All of these things. You summarized it well,
politicians,
Mike.
Unless there's a direct scandal, political careers or at least political offices aren't lost by a single event. It's a death by a thousand little scandals.
Okay.
And that's exactly what I think happened to Jennifer Roberts.
So we have less than a minute left in this segment, but the news organizations have called the election of the first female African-American mayor historic. Is it? And what do you think it will mean going forward? Mary.
I do think it's historic. An African-American woman in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's one reason why she was all over the news. I think in Charlotte, it was a slightly different story because if the national media didn't know about her, people in Charlotte did. She's been around budget and mayor pro tem and all of these things. And they felt that she was a steady hand. It's interesting they elected her while they elected very much a new council. And I think they want a new direction for the city.
We'll talk some more about Vi Lyles and the new council and what all this means to have African Americans in leadership positions in every key position in Charlotte when we come back at Charlotte Talks.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. And support this morning comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, business-minded lawyers committed to seeing the big picture. More information at robinsonbradshaw.com. And Trinity Episcopal School presenting Freedom Fet 2018, Raising, Educating, and Nurturing Boys and Girls, a discussion about the differences between male and female brains, January 25th, 6 p.m. at Trinity. All of us here at WFA wish you a safe and happy holiday season, and as you prepare to celebrate, we hope you'll choose to make a tax-deductible year-end contribution by Sunday, December 31st. Go online at WFAE.org or call us at 704-549-9000.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, we look back at 2017, Trump's first year, Washington politics to North Korean jitters, this year's big news stories, and where they're headed next. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point coming up at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, but it's a year-end review version of the local news roundup. We're looking back on the key stories that we talked a lot about over the last year in 2017. Glenn Berkins is here. I've already forgotten what year it is. It's almost over, so it doesn't matter. Glenn Berkins is here. He's the editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist and a contributor for Roll Call and WCCB-TV and others. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. We were just talking about Vi Lyles, her election as mayor of Charlotte, the first African-American woman to hold the office. But African-Americans are at the leadership roles of everything: school board, county commission, city council. The new district attorney in Charlotte is an African American. I probably left somebody. The
police
chief of police,
yeah,
is African American. What does this say to Charlotte in general, to the African American community in particular, and what kind of pressure does it put on African Americans? They're in charge now.
Mary, I'm going to let you take that
one. Glenn, we haven't heard from you in a while. Well, it's so interesting. We know that when white males and whites in general have been in charge, it's not an indictment or sort of seen as representing the whole group. And we've seen that that's just
right.
The opposite. When an African American, it's like if, you know, they have to be pristine. Look at our, you know, President Barack Obama has to be perfect, and all African Americans are judged in this way. So that's just dealing with something that shouldn't be, but is. It shows the basically the way demographics are going in the United States and in Charlotte, and it also shows the electoral power. We've seen African American women, in particular, drive voting all over this country.
Well, what does it say about voters that they're saying, you got the job?
Well, here's one thing I do want to say. Voters picked these candidates not solely by skin color in these positions.
Of course.
And
not.
So I think what we have here is their message won out.
Yeah.
And so, but Mary's guy, I mean, she's right. If it was a bunch of white guys running Charlotte right now, nobody would be asking is what does this mean overall?
Yeah, it reduces people to that quality.
Mm-hmm.
Which is insulting if you think about
that. Well, have we gotten to the point where people are being judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin?
I think in the case of the mayor's race, it's interesting in that Vi Lyles had to, particularly to win in the primary, have a great cross-section of support. And I think it also depends on an individual candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I think she would say that too.
But
they
doesn't that speak volumes? What I'm trying to get at here is, doesn't that speak volumes about how far we've come? We have a lot further to go, and we've seen a lot of bad things happen with regard to race relations in the last year or two. But we, at least, are overlooking that, are we not?
I think it speaks to two issues primarily. I think it speaks, one, to the changing demographics in America, but in Charlotte in particular. I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing that it speaks to is the divided nature, if you will, of white voters. They're split between Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. which allows the African American community to have a very large say in voting.
And
it's also worth noting that while politics and government are part of the power structure in Charlotte, it's not all of the power structure. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the business and corporate world, that is still overwhelmingly white. So this is not a city in which African Americans hold all the power. It is one where that balance is changing. But I think still the people who hold the bulk of the money are still white, and that's still part of the dynamic, whether you think that's a good thing
or a bad
thing.
I think that's very true, Anne. And also, let's see what the policy is going to be. Are we going to make some compromises on affordable housing, mixed-use housing, jobs? police accountability. It's one thing to say someone's in office. It's another thing to say the city's going to get behind making some change that's going to bring everyone in the community equally.
And those changes are inherently tough.
Yes.
In fact, I don't think the power structure when we talk about economics and the economy, I don't think that's changed at all.
No.
We're starting to see more African Americans at the head of some major organizations, hospital chains or what have you. Those changes aside, I won't call those changes superficial, but when you look at who is sitting on boards that, you know, whether it's Center City Partners or Chamber of Commerce or who owns business, it's still largely white males.
Okay. Another thing that happened this year was that older voters went to the polls and elected a bunch of young people to Charlotte City Council because the majority of the people who voted were older, and they elected a majority youth council. There's six members of the council who are under 40. And then 2 weeks ago, County Commissioner Dumont Clark said he would not run for re-election because of what he called a fine crop of young Democrats who really want the job. Are we at a generational tipping point here? Are we watching the changing of the guard, the passing of the torch?
I think more the changing of the guard than a tipping point. I mean, quite honestly, Charlotte is a plurality millennial city at this point. And if they really decided that they wanted to run Charlotte politically, they could do it. If every millennial was out there voting, there'd be no way to be able to stop them if they voted as a block. That's not exactly it. Notice that you said under 40. You've had city government and county government really dominated by, you know, retirees, for lack of a better way to say it, or people close to that for a while. I think this is a natural segue. And it comes at times like this where you do have an energized younger group, be it Democrat, Republican, or Independent, that say, you know what, it is time for me not just to sit here and either praise or complain the elected officials, but to step up and try my hand at it.
But it's about the message, not just about the demographics.
Correct.
So you didn't have people saying, I want a millennial, because you had a number of them run for school board in the same election. And they did not get that message
across.
And
it's hard for these younger people to do this because this is a full-time job in a part-time government. And they are paid on a part-time basis. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago when Braxton Winston brought up the fact that maybe they ought to go to four-year terms and maybe they ought to get a pay raise, because Julie Eiselt, who is the mayor pro tem, said when she added up all the hours that she worked in the last session, she made about $6 an hour. So isn't it remarkable that we have six young people under 40 who have families and full-time jobs able to do – maybe they'll find out they're not able to do, but they're able to do this, take on this added burden.
I might
add a responsibility.
I might differ just a little with what Tom said. Not entirely. I don't think it's entirely coincidence that it happened when it did, following the Keith Scott shooting, following what we've seen in terms of backlash in certain sectors of the population to the election of President Trump and what's happened. Change traditionally is led by younger people. If you go back to the civil rights era or whatever, it's amazing. We're talking about people who are in their 20s and 30s who step forward and change the nation. So I think we are at a place in Charlotte and in certain cities, whether we are nationally or not, I think it's too early to tell, where we probably are in a period of transition. Mm. And look at what's happening with the Me Too movement. People are restless, and they're saying, we want change. We want change in this area. We want change in that other area. And so it's not surprising that young people are going to step forward to lead that.
And that's what the new DA, Spencer Merriweather, says, that there's a lot of skepticism about the criminal justice system, and that's good because that will force a fresh direction, which is what he plans to take. And he's just taken office, so we'll see how that pans out over the next year. Well, another major story that unfolded over several months was a flood of Me Too stories as women spoke up about past sexual harassment and assault by men in power, and it exploded into the spotlight with movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, then widened across the media and entertainment worlds. It moved on to politics, then sports, where it landed on the Carolina Panthers' doorstep. Owner Jerry Richardson found himself at the center of an investigation into workplace misconduct. Sports Illustrated broke the story that the team made significant payments to at least four Panther employees over sexual harassment by Richardson. and at least one racial slur toward an African-American employee. Within hours of that bombshell, Richardson announced that he would sell the team at the end of the season, and then Richardson turned over day-to-day control of the team. We talked about these swift developments with the Charlotte Business Journal's Eric Spanberg and Darren Gant, a longtime Charlotte sports reporter with NBC Sports Pro Football Talk.
It's alarming how quickly this thing moved. It went from, boy, what's going to happen? Does this rise to the level of George Shinn? Effectively being run out of town on a rail to, oh, yeah, he's selling the team. I mean, this thing's moved at a startling pace. And, you know, I think a lot of people are still trying to process it. But, you know, some of the factors in this case are easy to overlook. I mean, he was going to, the plan was in place from the time he fired his sons in 2009 to sell the team within 2 years of his passing anyway. So there's some degree of wheels in motion on this. He's already been thinking about this for years to come. This just, as with everything, this just sped up the process.
Is this a reaction, do you think, on his part, based on anger that these accusations have come out, or a realization that if it's true, this kind of behavior no longer flies and you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Or is it just that he's 81 years old, he's had open heart surgery, he's a billionaire, he doesn't need this aggravation?
I think there's an element to that, Mike, because one thing about him in recent years, since the heart transplant surgery, he's really taken a step back. He used to be one of the most influential owners in league circles, was part of the compensation committee that sets Roger Goodell's exorbitant salary, was part of the relocation committee, was really a driver in the process of getting the NFL back to Los Angeles. The only problem was he took a terrible beating in that process. He wanted two teams to share a stadium in Carson. New money NFL, kind of spearheaded by Jerry Jones, sort of hijacked that process and resulted in the Rams building their own stadium in Inglewood. And that's a long way of saying his influence in the league wasn't what it used to be. He had resigned from all the committees he had previously been seated on, given up a lot of the control, stopped going to league meetings. So he had taken a big step back already.
One of the things that has been widely reported as a result of this article is some of the comments that Jerry Richardson is alleged to have made, like, show me how you wiggle to get those jeans up. I bet you had to lay down on your bed to fit into those jeans. Did you step into those jeans, or did you have to jump into them? This is on Jeans Day, which the Panthers evidently do on a regular basis. And a lot of employees, one employee was quoted as saying it was viewed as more of a creepy old man thing than as a threat. And another employee says, looking back, he was gaining our trust before doing things he shouldn't be doing. He volunteered to shave one woman's legs for her. This is a different generation. He's 81. This is not. I'm not excusing this behavior or any of the comments, but it's a different time. Does that matter?
No, it doesn't matter. I think that the country has spoken pretty clearly in the past 2 months or whatever it's been since the Harvey Weinstein report. I think that the mood of the country is very clear right now. Maybe it shifts in the future, but I'd say at this moment, just this is emblematic of what's going on.
I think it's an indicator of the overall worldview. I think one of the things you got to remember is people process through this, and I don't say this in any way, shape, or form to excuse what he's been accused of doing. He is a product of a different time and a different place. I mean, being an 81-year-old white man who grew up and made himself Southern gentry, he has a different mindset than the people he's around now. So the notion of a tattooed quarterback is something that never occurred to him. This man played with Johnny Unitas. That's what, in his mind, quarterbacks looked like. So when Cam Newton fell into his lap in 2011, I think he was forced into a quick realization that times have changed. And I think that's probably, as much as anything, what I take away from this entire story is that the world changed around Jerry Richardson, and he never caught up with it. Yeah. I mean, the things that he always assumed as a captain of industry to be a normal part of business simply aren't acceptable, simply aren't normal.
Well, the change in ownership is one of those stories that we'll be following into the new year. Okay, let's change the topic. I'm very grateful that I do not carry change anymore and that we do not have a jar because I'd have to put money in it because I'm
here
going to
comes.
Say the dreaded words.
Here it comes.
After almost a year of wrangling and being in front of the brunt of jokes around the nation and a year of economic loss, HB2 went into the trash bin. Democratic Governor Cooper signed a new law from the Republican legislature repealing HB2, a rare example of bipartisan cooperation. What's the upshot of all this?
Everybody seems to dislike the compromise that ended it. That's what this year has been about.
But isn't that always a compromise? You win, you lose. Isn't that always the case in a compromise?
You know, in theory, I think both sides have reason to be unhappy with this in terms of particular compromise. But I'm not sure this story is written and finished. I don't think there's a period at the end of this particular chapter or even this particular sentence for a simple reason that what everyone agreed to is everything would revert back to what it was before the Charlotte Ordinance, and then no one can change that status quo that's frozen in time until 2020. But what happens after that? What happens when that moratorium ends? What happens when cities are not barred by statute from passing non-discrimination ordinances or expanding them? And what happens with the General Assembly, and how do they react to it? So I think we're basically right now we're at an extended halftime until we wait to see how the rest of this is played out.
So proponents of HB2 will say that we weren't really hurt by this. The opponents of HB2 said, yes, we lost tons of revenue. We did lose all these games and concerts and Broadway shows, et cetera, that wouldn't come to North Carolina. Have we recovered from that? The ACC tournament came back this year. Have we recovered? Are most of the people who pulled out deciding we'll come back?
I think that question maybe fails to take into account the people who were supposed to benefit from the Charlotte Ordinance. And I think you can say, proponents of HB2 say it didn't hurt us and the others say whatever. But I think we have to look at this as a civil rights, human rights issue as well. And I think that's what gets lost in the debate. And I think that's what Tom was going at.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the economic opportunities lost, there's still a group of people who are exactly where they were before.
So what, if anything, have we learned from this excruciating experience over the last year?
We've learned that today in America, it's fascinating to me that corporate America can be as strong an advocate and take stands that as a kid growing up, I never would expect to see major Fortune 500 companies take.
And sports leagues.
Don't mess with – if you're going to mess with the sports league in North Carolina as a politician, make sure it's not the NCAA.
Right.
I think it shows, again, how divided we are as a people and how we tend now to distrust the other regardless of what makes us different from each other instead of just trying to get along.
Yeah. I also think the state has learned – how a reputation can shift so quickly. You see now other states that are considering these laws, the legislators are saying, oh, but look what happened in North Carolina.
Do you think they care?
I'm not sure.
The people that passed HB2.
Well, no, I think they felt that
was voted on their convictions. Do you think they care what the rest of the country thinks about their convictions?
Possibly not. But I'm just saying that the state as a whole has seen the image of what North Carolina is and can be shift. You've seen it with the voting thing as well. But I feel that that is very interesting.
And I think transgender people are seen in a way and understood in a way they had not been before all this discussion.
When we come back, North Carolina goes to court and goes to court and goes to court and goes to court. That's when we come back on Charlotte Talks and the year-end roundup of news stories.
Good morning. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. Support this hour comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details on the Subaru Share the Love event at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. Jazz pianist Robert Glasper remixes Miles Davis with modern hip-hop, soul, and R&B. That's in the 11 o'clock hour of On Point. And coming up next on On Point at 10, we look back at 2017, Trump's first year, from Washington politics to North Korean jitters, this year's big news stories, and where they're headed next.
So it's been a long year of news, but you've made it. The new year is coming. So resolve to be more informed. Listen to Morning Edition every day whenever it fits into your schedule. The news is waiting for you. Join Marshall Terry weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the year-end news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB-TV, and Glenn Berkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. The state has spent a considerable amount of time this year, and probably a lot of money, too, dealing with North Carolina's laws and maps and going to court. The Supreme Court refused to revive the state's voter ID law that a federal appeals court had struck down, saying it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. The law was put in place by Republicans, saying this would stop what they said was widespread voter fraud in the state. That was strike one. But that wasn't the only instance of courts being in opposition with our legislature. The Supreme Court also forced a redrawing of maps of congressional voting districts they said had been racially gerrymandered. Where does that stand at this moment in time, Tom?
Well, it's still waiting for final clarification on fixing it all up. But it's worth noting this is a different stance from the other case you're about to mention,
yes.
Which is immediately after hearing that the lower federal court found the 12th congressional district, which is here in Mecklenburg County, and the first, which is north and east of the state, that found that they were illegal racial gerrymanders. The General Assembly got quickly involved and redrew all the legislative maps,
That's
at least
right.
for the U.S. House. So just remember that as we move on to strike three.
Go ahead. Take a
strike. Oh, no. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No.
Strike three.
The legislature and the consultants. Go ahead.
No, strike three is a case that actually caught us all off guard, I think it's fair to say, which is when a lower federal panel, and this was again held up by the U.S. Supreme Court, ruled that 19 state House and 9 state Senate
right.
legislative districts were also illegal racial gerrymanders. All this in a matter of weeks over the summer. It was fascinating.
So they have been drawing and redrawing and redrawing maps, and the court finally said, I don't like any of your maps, at least in the legislative area, I think. And they brought in a consultant.
Special master is the term.
To draw the map. He has drawn the map. Where does that stand?
Well, officially, we're not going to know until early next month in terms of exactly what they're going to rule. This basically gave a menu of map options for the judges to decide. The rationale they had for bringing the special master is they don't want to delay since, 2018 is an election year for state legislature. So they want to have all of their options in place so when they do have a ruling, it can be immediately – the maps can be immediately enacted.
The governor – has also been fighting things in court, what he sees as the legislature's attempt to dilute his power. What were some of those actions, and where do they stand at the end of the year?
Just about everything. I mean, start with his cabinet. The North Carolina Senate decided they were going to enact and take advantage of a rarely, if ever, used clause in the North Carolina Constitution that stated that they had to confirm Governor Cooper's picks to run agencies, his secretaries. That was a long court case. Eventually, the court decided, well, the legislature hasn't said no to any of your nominated secretaries yet, Governor Cooper, so you don't have harm. So they kind of put it on hold. And then all of a sudden, instead of these bruising confirmation hearings that were promised, it was a pretty clean run for all of his cabinet nominees. You've got the elections and ethics board mergers. You've got the school board versus – and Anne's over here nodding her head. This is the one I think that's still definitely got legs. But there was actually – this is how – just in summary, this is how bad it got. The state legislature, the Republican leadership, was claiming that Governor Cooper was filing about a lawsuit a month against the General Assembly. And it was so prevalent a statement that Fact Check NC had to go through and rate whether or not that was an accurate claim. And
so,
it's mostly false.
So at the beginning of the year, North Carolina was the center of attention around the country, I think, for a lot of things that were going on here. Maybe at the end of the year, it's more like Alabama. But I want to get back to that image issue that we alluded to. Senate leader Phil Berger says the state is excelling under the GOP's vision. He notes a steep drop in the unemployment rate, lower taxes, and a higher high school graduation rate. He said, "Our vision is North Carolina as really a beacon for the rest of the nation, not only in tax policy and economic environment, but also as a place where a top-level quality of life can be experienced." That's Phil Berger. But we're also being noticed nationally for something else. The New York Times Magazine in June published an article that was titled, "Is North Carolina the Future of American Politics?" They say our state is where, quote, "all the passions and pathologies of American politics writ large are played out writ small and with even more intensity." Now, they pointed to the fact that since the Republicans took control of the legislature, there's been a bigger and quicker shift to the right than in any other state. That was before, however, the November election, in which a Democrat became a neighboring state's governor. It was before Vi Lyles handily beat a Republican opponent, before Democrat Doug Jones beat Republican Roy Moore in Alabama, before Donald Trump's approval rating had dropped to the, I don't know, is it the lowest in history now? I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, for
since
this
it's been
phase.
Measured.
So are we in fact the standard bearer for where the country is going, or was that only a momentary blip?
Well, it's interesting, too, because that article pointed out that they went so hard right in a state that's kind of purple, if you look at how we are divided. And in a sense, the division which works across all the country, I think, is it's less Democratic and Republican than rural and urban. You see, in many states, cities voting in one way.
And that's what it boiled down to in Alabama.
Another. Yes.
Yeah, and I have to say, too, you mentioned all the changes with North Carolina. A lot of the tax policy, a lot of the real the more controversial stuff, at least in the eyes of Democrats, it had already been done. It was done in a state called Kansas, and it was a very interesting and arguably a failed experiment. Yeah. Now, there are some very significant differences between North Carolina and Kansas, namely, at least in terms for this conversation, Kansas is a deep red state. We are a purple state. Kansas is also shrinking in population. We're growing in population. So when you look at, the difference writ large and writ small, North Carolina I don't think is so much a harbinger as it happens to be representative. But we have our own little twists and tweaks in the fact that America itself is not necessarily a purple country because it's made up of elections that are held in individual red or blue areas.
Right.
And North Carolina, we don't have that. So the other thing,
the other thing that I would say is that North Carolina, in North Carolina, the Democrats kind of built their own coffin. If you recall, Barack Obama carried North Carolina in 2008. 2 years later, the Democrats stayed home in 2010, and they lost big. And that happened to be the year of the U.S. Census. Mm-hmm. And when the U.S. Census is taken, all the districts are redrawn. So I don't think that North Carolina is representative. I think North Carolina was a victim of some very unfortunate circumstances.
And even though you can't say that we're like Alabama, I do think you can look at some lessons. And the Republicans are probably trying to solidify their gains because they're seeing energized voters among people of color, among African Americans. It's showing in the election since then. Mm-hmm. So they're probably looking ahead and thinking, wow, in North Carolina, which is more diverse, we're going to get a whole lot of folks out there voting. And they may not like some of the things we're doing.
Bringing it back home, 2017 was a year of soul searching, at least in Charlotte, since the unrest following the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott in 2016. There's been a lot of conversation, public and private, on this program and others, about economic opportunity, a lot about the lack of upward mobility in Charlotte. There's been an examination of police treatment of minorities and police efforts to engage minority communities. Although the Citizens Review Board split on their review of the Scott shooting this year, they later voted against CMPD for the very first time in their 20-year history in another case. Is all this self-examination adding up to something? Will it result in improved situations, circumstances?
Well, 2017, I think, was also the year in these areas that Charlotte grew up a bit, when they realized we aren't immune from these kinds of issues like police accountability and economic inequality that other cities have been grappling with. So I think they were jolted in a way that they hadn't been, and perhaps that we saw it in the elections, and that will lead to some more actions.
Speaking of economic opportunity, we received this report this year after a 2-year study by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Opportunity Task Force on how to change the trajectory for the city's poor. County Commissioner Pat Cotham said there was nothing earth-shattering in the report. She said, we already know the things that need to happen. We need the courage to do it. The new mayor said that the time for talking is over. It's now time to do. And I guess she's referring in part to that as well. So what did the report say needs to happen? And why does it take courage to do it? And is there political will to do any of it?
Well, the report, I'll tackle the easy part first. The report basically said things that are going to make sense. You have economic disparities in Charlotte, significant ones, based on things like lack of affordable housing, lack of job training, lack of good quality jobs throughout all areas of the city, lack of quality and reliable transportation, lack of daycare for low-income folks. These are not earth-shattering. These are not, you know, groundbreaking, but we hope that they're eye-opening because at least now it's been said publicly. These are things everybody did know about. So why does it take courage? Because you really, really, really have to take a stand to start doing things like take affordable housing, something everybody in the city campaigned on in the last election, saying, oh, we're doing great, but we need more. So where do you want to put all the affordable housing? If you cluster it all in the same area, you can, in fact, create what is, in essence, a ghetto. And that is not good for anyone. Mm. So are you going to start putting some affordable housing in different parts, more affluent parts of the city? If you want to really make a difference and integrate, that's what you got
to
do.
So the stakes are high, and we'll have to stay tuned to see how they handle this in the year ahead. School bonds. Let's talk about schools for a second. School bonds passed overwhelmingly despite some opposition in the northern part of the county. But Rhonda Lennon, who represents that part of the county, has become the vice chair of the new school board. And CMS has a new superintendent this year, Clayton Wilcox. There was so much going on prior to his arrival with the construction of new people assignment things have seemed relatively quiet since he has arrived. Would that be an accurate observation? And will he start kicking the can?
Well, I think, we've had so many shows in which we've talked about CMS at a crossroads over the years. Uh-huh. And it feels like this year, after a couple of years of standing at that crossroads and arguing and checking the map and where are we going to go, this is kind of a year when the school district started down a road. They did get Clayton Wilcox in place. They got a student assignment plan in place. They got bonds approved. They've got, new school board members in place. And so I think there's going to be a little less of this sort of the obvious public policy stuff and more focus on the really actually harder questions about how you really change all of these schools, because the student assignment was never going to be the big solution to all of our educational woes. It was going to maybe, if we do it right, lay the groundwork. Now how do we make sure that you're actually getting a good educational opportunity at each of those schools, regardless of the demographics, regardless of whether you're disabled or gifted?
Lightning round time. We have 4 minutes left. Charlotte School of Law went belly up this year after a long struggle. The 11-year-old school was put on probation by the American Bar Association. It lost its accreditation.
For a lightning round.
That the attorney general said, you're gone. So what was the last straw?
When they couldn't get the license to reopen and the state attorney general said, you guys don't get to open until you can prove to us that you've got funding to do it.
And the people who suffered here are the students. What's happened to them since it closed?
They are actually still wrangling as the year comes to a close over some of the paperwork and details of whether their loans will be forgiven. There's apparently some problems with
that. And federal prosecutors have been investigating that school for more than a year. Is that investigation continuing and expanding to the mothership in Florida?
Probably not to the mothership. It's actually, INFLA is, they use LLCs. I seriously doubt it'll get all the way back to there. Yeah. We'll see.
Johnson C. Smith University gets a new president on January 1st. His arrival has been eclipsed essentially in the last several weeks by the school being put on a 12-month probation because of financial concerns. We talked about this a few weeks ago. What's going on here, Glenn?
150-year-old HBCU celebrating its 150th year this year. Educated generations of African Americans. I think after at least 2 years of hearing people say that there are serious financial issues at that school, it was confirmed recently when the accrediting organization put it on 12-month probation over financial concerns.
Is part of the problem here the fact that most historically black colleges and universities are suffering financially?
That's certainly part of it, and some are suffering more than others. Those smaller private colleges that are affiliated with faith organizations or faith churches?
Given the role that that school plays on the west side of town and in the African-American community, are they likely to be allowed to go under? Won't somebody come in and fix this?
Well, it's worth noting that very near the end of the year, the university announced that it had met its $150 million fundraising goal that they set out. And this has actually been over the course of several years, not one big chunk, but that they have raised $150 million in corporate and individual donations. So there clearly is some support. This is not a Charlotte school of law. I don't think we're going to see it go away in the next foreseeable future.
Charlotte had a shot this year at Major League Soccer. They intend to expand the league. Charlotte Motor Speedway's CEO Marcus Smith headed an ownership group. They couldn't get together with the county or the city. Was it simply that the timing was bad for Charlotte, that we turned a corner on trying to be a big league player because we already have two big league teams? What went on there?
I will simply say that if you want to spend a whole lot of taxpayer money on a private team in a private stadium, you probably shouldn't do it during an election year. I'm not saying the votes would have necessarily been different, but I think there's a chance.
We started the year with a lot of major marches around the country and in Charlotte. The Women's March came to Charlotte. A lot of people participated. There was a march by and for immigrants on the day without immigrants, immigrants that packed Marshall Park and went to downtown all over the place. Was it more surprising that Charlotte took part in these marches, or has it surprised you that there haven't been more marches like this in the year?
Well, there certainly was a thirst for them. I was covering the Women's March. It was supposed to be 3,000, and more than 10,000 showed up. More to come, I believe. It energized a lot of folks.
And in a strange way, we are ending the year with a Women's March, this whole Me Too movement. They aren't marching in the streets literally, but it is a movement.
That's a really good point.
And again, African-American women, a big part of it.
Well, we will leave it there because we have to leave the year behind. We have to move on to 2018. And
Happy New Year.
We have to buy our party hats. I want to thank Glenn Birkins, Ann Doss Helms, Mary C. Curtis, Tom Bullock for their assistance on this program today and throughout all of 2017. See you next year.